morning, and thank you. I'm pleased to be here and to share this information with you today. So the title of the presentation is Evidence-Based Approaches that Educate Youth to Minimize High-Risk Behaviors. Just a brief overview of what I'm going to be covering. I'm going to look at prevalence first of high-risk behaviors among adolescents, talk about some prevention principles that were developed by NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and then just share with you briefly a couple of findings from evidence-based studies. So some of the prevalence. If we look at this chart, we see the risk behaviors on the left and the three racial ethnic groups to the right. We can see that, we see that in terms of ever smoked cigarettes, to respond to that question, Hispanic youth were smoking at a higher rate than the other two groups, drinking alcohol as well. In terms of current marijuana use, black youth were a little higher than the other two groups. And then if you look down to birth control pill, how to protect themselves, we see the rates were fairly low, pretty low, very much different for black and Hispanic youth than for white youth. And a question that was asked also on this, the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey, was looking at how much they were taught, and as well as their attitudes towards catching infections and drug use. And so in response to that question, most of them, the majority of them, did get some kind of education in school about HIV and AIDS. This chart is from the Monitoring the Future study, which is funded by NIDA through Michigan, University of Michigan. And this looks at prevalence of past year drug use among 12th graders. You see, for alcohol, the rates are very high. 62% of youth indicated that they did smoke cigarettes or, alcohol, use alcohol. For marijuana, we see the rates 36% and going down. I wouldn't read them all out to you. You can see them there, okay? Look at the percentage of students who report using synthetic marijuana in the past year by grade. We see even among eighth graders, and typically the Monitoring the Future looks at students in eighth, tenth, and twelfth grade. So we see for eighth graders, the rates are pretty high too, even though across all three grades, the rates were slightly reduced between 2012 and 2013. And for 12th graders, it's denoting a significant difference between 2012, a reduction for them. Okay. I thought that this slide was interesting in terms of how kids obtain these drugs. And as you'll see, whether they're using it for medical use or for non-medical use, and, you know, the green bars, well, as the code shows, medical marijuana states and non-medical marijuana states. And I believe there, last time I looked, there were just a few states that had that marijuana use was legal. So the first bar denotes, and I'm sorry I don't have a pointer, but given by a friend, see, over 60% of them got their marijuana from a friend. Some were bought it from a friend, and that was about 50%, about half of them. Bought it from a dealer or a stranger, that's a little lower. And along the continuum, given by a relative, some other method, or bought it from a relative, or took it from a relative, or their own marijuana prescription, was very small, very, very small. And that was a significant difference between the medical marijuana states and the non-medical marijuana states. And then someone else's marijuana prescription, which is the last bar. So youth are finding all kinds of ways to obtain these drugs. So I want to share with you some prevention principles. Based on the data and what we've been seeing, NIDA developed a set of prevention principles. And these principles are organized, there are 16, and they're organized in three different areas. One is looking at risk and protective factors. The second is looking at prevention planning, which looks at family programs, school programs, and community programs. And the third area is prevention program delivery, how you deliver the program. So in terms of risk and protective factors, the first four principles relate to these. And it says that prevention programs should enhance protective factors and reverse or reduce risk factors. They should also address all forms of drug abuse, either alone or in combination. And that's for legal drugs as well as for illegal drugs. Because, you know, smoking is legal, right? So the third principle is that programs should address the type of drug abuse problem in the local community and target modifiable risk factors, as well as strengthen identified protective factors. And then the fourth principle is that programs should be tailored to address risks that are specific to populations or audience characteristics, such as age, gender, ethnicity. So you target your program depending on who, you know, the group you're, in other words, you tailor the program to the needs of the particular group you're working with, so you can improve the effectiveness of the program. Then we look at prevention planning. And I said they were family-based, school-based. So the family-based programs, Principle 5 says, enhance family bonding and relationships and include parenting skills. They should also practice in developing, discussing, and enforcing family policies on substance abuse and training in drug education and information. And school programs should be designed to intervene as early as infancy to address risk factors for drug abuse, such as aggressive behavior, poor social skills, and academic difficulties. And Principle 7, still looking at school programs, programs for elementary school children should target improving academic and social-emotional learning to address risk factors for drug abuse, such as early aggression, academic failure, and school dropout. Education should focus on skills such as self-control, communication, and social problem solving. Principle 8 says that programs for middle and junior high, as well as high school students, should increase academic social competence with skills such as study habits and academic support, peer relationships, drug resistance skills, and communication. And community programs should be aimed at key transition points, for example, as they transition to middle school. And these programs can be have beneficial effects even among high-risk families and children. They can reduce labeling, and they can promote bonding to school and community. Also, combining two or more effective programs, such as family programs and school-based programs, can be more effective than a single program alone. You know, you have the multiplier effect. Then Principle 11 says that reaching populations in multiple settings, for example, schools, clubs, faith-based organizations, and the media, are most effective when they present consistent community-wide messages in each setting. Okay, in terms of program delivery, when communities adapt programs to match their needs and their community norms, or differing cultural requirements, they should retain the core elements of the original research-based intervention. The program should be long-term with repeated interventions to reinforce the original prevention goals. Research shows that the benefits from middle school prevention programs diminish unless there's follow-up in high school. Programs should include teacher training on good classroom management practices, such as rewarding appropriate student behavior. Such techniques will help to foster students' positive behavior, their achievement, their academic motivation, and school bonding. Then programs are most effective when they employ interactive techniques, such as peer discussion groups and parent role playing that allow for active involvement in learning about drug abuse and reinforcing skills. Research-based prevention programs can be cost-effective. Research continues to show that each dollar invested in prevention is a cost saving of up to $10 in treatment for alcohol or other substance use. So, using these prevention principles, I'll share some research findings. And basically, they're showing that prevention approaches enhance protective factors and reduce risk factors, which goes back to the first principle. So this was a nurse family practice partnership study that evaluated three randomized trials. I'm clicking on the back arrow, which works on my computer, on this one. So this study evaluated three randomized trials with high-risk teenage mothers who received nursing home visits during pregnancy until the child was 2 years old. The expected outcomes were to have significant effects on abuse and neglect, children's behavioral development, the mother's economic well-being, time to the next baby, and the children's arrest as adolescents. So when they followed up these children 12 years later, those who had received the intervention had lower past month alcohol use, lower tobacco use or marijuana use than children who were in the control group who did not get the nurse visit training. Their reading and their math scores also were higher than those of the control group. Remember, we said in one of the principles that there's a crossover effect, that even though you're working on one particular area, it transfers sometimes to other areas. And so certainly there seems to be, this study shows that. The study also supports the principle that intervening early in a child's life can have long-term effects on a broad array of outcomes, such as substance abuse, mental health, and academic achievement. Looking at another study called the Good Behavior Game Study, I don't know if some of you might have heard it or used it yourself, classroom teams in elementary school earn small rewards for being on task and for being cooperative. The goals were to reduce classroom aggressive and disruptive behavior among children to enhance classroom teaching and learning, and also to prevent later drug abuse, delinquency, school failure, and other problem outcomes. So at follow-up in high school, it was found that males in the good behavior game classrooms who were rated as highly aggressive in first and second grade by their teachers and then followed through high school were significantly more likely to have less drug abuse or dependence disorders in young adulthood than those students in the control group. However, this finding did not hold true for females. There was no difference in their drug abuse or dependence in young adulthood in relation to the ratings, teacher ratings of aggression. Another study was the life skills study by Botvin. His participants were middle school students who were followed up in young adulthood. And the program goal was to teach them alcohol and drug resistance skills with material that was designed to facilitate the development of important personal and social skills. The findings were that students who received the life skills training engaged in high-risk behaviors at a much lower level than those students who are in the control group. So, to close out, we see that long-term effects, the prevention intervention that were interventions that were implemented during early developmental periods have effects during adolescence and later developmental stages. For universal interventions, they have an impact on higher risk youth, and there are crossover effects, so that prevention interventions can have an effect on multiple risk behaviors, including those that are not targeted and not a focus of the intervention, as we saw with the kids in the good behavior game. And that's it. Thank you.